became communist. The communist Soviet Union was then officially established in December 1922 with the Union of the Russian, Ukrainian, Belarusian, and Transcaucasia Soviet Republics, where each was ruled by local Marxists. On February 1, 1924, the USSR was recognized by the British Empire. The same year, a Soviet constitution was approved, legitimizing the December 1922 Union. The stated purpose of the one-party state was to ensure that capitalist exploitation would not return to the Soviet Union, and that the principles of democratic centralism would be most effective in representing the people's will in a practical manner. Debate over the future of the economy provided the background for a power struggle in the years after Lenin's death in 1924. Initially, Lenin was to be replaced by a troika consisting of Grigory Zinoviev of Ukraine, Lev Kamenev of Moscow, and Joseph Stalin of Georgia. On April 3, 1922, Stalin was named the General Secretary of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. Lenin had appointed Stalin the head of the Workers' and Peasants' Inspectorate, which gave Stalin considerable power. By gradually consolidating his influence and isolating and outmaneuvering his rivals within the party, Stalin became the undisputed leader of the Soviet Union and, by the end of the 1920s, established totalitarian rule. A look now at Joseph Stalin. In October 1927, Grigory Zinoviev and Leon Trotsky were expelled from the Central Committee and forced into exile. In 1928, Stalin introduced the first five-year plan for building a socialist economy. While encompassing the internationalism expressed by Lenin throughout the revolution, it also aimed to build socialism in one country. The state assumed control over all existing industrial enterprises and undertook an extensive program of industrialization. In agriculture, rather than adhering to the lead-by-example policy advocated by Lenin, forced collectivization of farms was implemented all over the country. Famines ensued, causing millions of deaths. The opposing survivors were persecuted and many sent to do forced labor. Social upheaval continued in the mid-1930s. Stalin's great purge of the opposition resulted in the execution or detainment of many who had participated in the October Revolution with Lenin. According to declassified Soviet archives in 1937 and 1938, more than 1.5 million people were arrested and 681,692 of them were shot. There was an average of 1,000 executions a day. These deaths during the 1930s, as a whole, were in the range of 10 to 11 million. Yet despite the turmoil of the mid to late 1930s, the Soviet Union developed a powerful industrial economy in the years before World War II. Stalin was making communism work. The early 1930s saw closer cooperation between the West and the USSR. From 1932 to 1934, the Soviet Union participated in the World Disarmament Conference. In 1933, diplomatic relations between the United States and the USSR were established. In September 1934, the Soviet Union joined the League of Nations. After the Spanish Civil War broke out in 1936, the USSR actively supported the Republican forces against the Nationalists, who were supported by Fascist Italy and Nazi Germany. In December 1936, Stalin unveiled a new Soviet constitution. The constitution was seen as a personal triumph for Stalin, who on this occasion was described in the communist newspaper as a genius of the new world, the wisest man of the epoch, the great leader of communism. By contrast, Western historians and historians from former Soviet-occupied countries have viewed the Constitution as a meaningless propaganda document. The late 1930s saw the USSR begin to shift towards the German Axis powers, which were a pact between Germany, Italy, and Japan. Chapter 8. World War II. In 1938, after the United Kingdom and France had concluded the Munich Agreement with Germany, the USSR also dealt with the Nazis, both militarily and economically. During extensive talks, the two countries concluded the German-Soviet Non-Aggression Pact and the German-Soviet Commercial Agreement. The Non-Aggression Pact made possible Soviet occupation of Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, Bessarabia, northern Bukovina, and eastern Poland. Stalin, therefore, sided with Hitler just before the beginning of World War II. Stalin invades Finland. In late November of the same year, unable to coerce the Republic of Finland by diplomatic means into moving its border 16 miles back from Leningrad, Joseph Stalin ordered the invasion of Finland. Stalin sides with Japan. In the east, the Soviet military won several decisive victories during border clashes with the Japanese Empire in 1938 and 1939. However, in April 1941, USSR signed the Soviet-Japanese Neutrality Pact with the Empire of Japan, recognizing the territorial integrity of Manchukuo, a Japanese puppet state. Stalin, therefore, sided with Japan just before the beginning of World War II. Hitler attacks Austria and Poland. Hitler begins World War II by annexing Austria and invading Poland in 1939. It becomes Germany, Italy, and Japan against primarily Britain and France. The U.S. declares war in December 1941 after Japan bombs Pearl Harbor. The concerns and fears of communism take a back seat to the aggressions of Germany and Japan. Hitler makes his biggest mistake of the war. Germany broke the treaty with the USSR and invaded the Soviet Union on June 22, 1941, starting what was known in the USSR as the Great Patriotic War. The Red Army stopped the seemingly invincible German army at the Battle of Moscow, aided by an unusually harsh winter. The Battle of Stalingrad, which lasted from late 1942 to early 1943, dealt a severe blow to the Germans from which they never fully recovered. It became a turning point in the war. After Stalingrad, Soviet forces drove through Eastern Europe to Berlin, and Germany surrendered in 1945. The German army suffered 80% of its military deaths in the Eastern Front with the USSR. Soviet Premier Joseph Stalin, U.S. President Franklin D. Roosevelt, and British Prime Minister Winston Churchill conferred in Tehran in 1943 to discuss how to end the war. D-Day, June 6, 1944, the Allies invade Germany-controlled France. The Allies, under General Eisenhower, invade France in the final battles to end World War II. The war in the European theater of World War II ends May 8, 1945. The U.S. drops the atom bomb on Japan on August 6 and 9, 1945. The USSR, in fulfillment of its agreement with the Allies at the Yalta Conference, denounced the Soviet-Japanese Neutrality Pact in April 1945 and invaded Manchukuo and other Japan-controlled territories on August 9, 1945. This conflict ended with decisive Soviet victory. The Soviets claimed that this victory contributed to the unconditional surrender of Japan and the end of World War II. Chapter 9, USSR Becomes Major World Power. The USSR had taken the greatest burden in World War II, losing 27 million people. Despite this, it emerged as a superpower in the post-war period. Once denied diplomatic recognition by the Western world, the Soviet Union had official relations with practically every nation by the late 1940s. The Soviet Union became a member of the United Nations at its foundation in 1945. It then became one of the five permanent members of the UN Security Council, which gave it the right to veto any of its resolutions. Their successes and strengths made them and communism even more feared. Russia and the Soviet Union had suffered many invasions from the West throughout history. Stalin sought to create a buffer zone of subservient East European countries, most of which the Soviet Army had occupied in the course of the war. Taking advantage of its military occupation of these countries, the Soviet Union actively assisted local communist parties in coming to power. By 1948, 7 Eastern European countries, Albania, Bulgaria, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Poland, Romania, and Yugoslavia, had communist governments. The Soviet Union initially maintained control through the use of troops, security police, and the Soviet diplomatic service. On March 5, 1946, Winston Churchill made note of this in his Iron Curtain speech at Westminster College in Fulton, Missouri. He stated,
"From Stettin in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic, an iron curtain has descended across the continent. Behind that line lie all the capitals of the ancient states of Central and Eastern Europe. Warsaw, Berlin, Prague, Vienna, Budapest, Belgrade, Bucharest, and Sofia. All these famous cities and the populations around them lie in what I must call the Soviet sphere. And all our subjects, in one form or another, not only to Soviet influence, but to a very high and in some cases increasing measure of control from Moscow. Yet Athens alone, Greece, with its immortal glories, is free to decide its future at an election under British, American, and French observation. The Russian-dominated Polish government has been encouraged to make enormous and wrongful inroads upon Germany, and mass expulsions of millions of Germans on a scale grievous and undreamed of are now taking place. The communist parties, which were very small in all these eastern states of Europe, have been raised to preeminence and power far beyond their numbers and are seeking everywhere to obtain totalitarian control. Police governments are prevailing in nearly every case, and so far, except in Czechoslovakia, there is no true democracy."
Some historians view Churchill's Iron Curtain speech as the formal beginning of the Cold War. The Soviet Union maintained its status as one of the world's two superpowers for 4 decades through its hegemony in Eastern Europe, military strength, economic strength, aid to developing countries, and scientific research, especially in space technology and weaponry. During the immediate post-war period, the Soviet Union rebuilt and expanded its economy while maintaining its strictly centralized control. It aided post-war reconstruction in the countries of Eastern Europe while turning them into satellite states, binding them in a military alliance, the Warsaw Pact, in 1955, and an economic organization, the Council for Mutual Economic Assistance, or Comecon, from 1949 to 1991. Later, the Comecon supplied aid to the eventually victorious Chinese Communist Party and saw its influence grow elsewhere in the world. The Cold War starts in earnest. Fearing the USSR's ambitions, the Soviet Union's wartime allies, the United Kingdom and the United States, became its enemies. In the ensuing Cold War, the two sides clashed indirectly, using mostly proxies so as not to have personal conflicts. The maximum territorial extent of countries in the world under the Soviet model included Cuban after their revolution of 1959, China before the official Sino-Soviet split of 1961, and numerous movements worldwide from South America to India. Stalin died on March 5, 1953. Without a mutually agreeable successor, the highest Communist Party officials opted to rule the Soviet Union jointly. Nikita Khrushchev won the power struggle by the mid-1950s. Moscow considered Eastern Europe to be a buffer zone for the forward defense of its western borders and ensured its control of the region by transforming the Eastern European countries into satellite states. Soviet military force was used to suppress anti-communist uprisings in Hungary and Poland in 1956. In the late 1950s, a confrontation with China regarding the USSR's rapprochement with the West and what Mao Zedong perceived as Khrushchev's revisionism led to the Sino-Soviet split. This resulted in a break throughout the global communist movement, with communist regimes in Albania, Cambodia, and Somalia choosing to ally with China in place of the USSR. USSR takes the lead in space. During this period, the Soviet Union continued to realize great scientific and technological advancements. They launched the first artificial satellite, Sputnik 1, in 1957, a living dog, Laika, in 1957, the first human being, Yuri Gagarin, in 1961, the first woman in space, Valentina Tereshkova, in 1963, Alexei Leonov, the first person to walk in space in 1965, the first soft landing on the moon by spacecraft Luna 9 in 1966, and the first moon rovers, Lunokhod 1 and Lunokhod 2. USSR's achievements in technology caused increased concerns for the threat of communism. The U.S. and Britain increased their military budgets. Khrushchev initiated the Khrushchev's Thaw, a complex shift in political, cultural, and economic life in the Soviet Union. That included some openness and contact with other nations, and new social and economic policies with more emphasis on commodity goods, allowing living standards to rise dramatically while maintaining high levels of economic growth. Censorship was relaxed as well. Khrushchev's reforms in agriculture and administration, however, were generally unproductive. Khrushchev and Kennedy. During his presidential campaign, Kennedy had repeatedly spoken of a missile gap between the U.S. and Soviet Union. Despite being briefed by the Pentagon that the U.S. had more missiles than the Soviets, Kennedy maintained his claim that the U.S. had less. Khrushchev, of course, knew better. He felt like a man boxed in by enemies. He felt that he had to do something. After the 1960 election, Khrushchev began to test the new president. He needed to know just how strong Kennedy would be. The Berlin Wall. In the summer of 1961, Khrushchev applied pressure to Berlin and built a wall surrounding West Berlin. The wall separated the communist and democratic sections of the city. The wall became a physical symbol of Churchill's Iron Curtain metaphor. In 1963, President Kennedy made his famous Ich bin ein Berliner speech, speaking from a platform erected on the steps of Rathaus Schoenberg, a borough city hall, for an audience of 450,000. Kennedy said,
2,000 years ago, the proudest boast was Civis Romanus Sum. Today, in the world of freedom, the proudest boast is Ich bin ein Berliner. All free men, wherever they may live, are citizens of Berlin. And therefore, as a free man, I take pride in the word Ich bin ein Berliner.
But the communists made no change in the wall. Chapter 10, The Cuban Missile Crisis. Kennedy felt that Khrushchev was becoming too bold, and he therefore believed that he should reveal to Khrushchev that there was, in fact, no missile gap. Khrushchev had always known the U.S. had more missiles, but now he knew that the Americans knew. Khrushchev also knew that Soviet missiles were only powerful enough to be launched against Europe, but U.S. missiles were capable of striking the entire Soviet Union. Khrushchev feared that he needed to do something about the United States' stronger position in missiles. If the Soviet Union lost the arms race so badly, he worried, it would invite a first-strike nuclear attack from the U.S. Consequently, Khrushchev began looking for a way to counter the United States' lead. He considered that the U.S. had missiles in Turkey, just 150 miles from the USSR. He needed to get some of his missiles closer to the U.S. Cuba was only 90 miles off the coast of Florida. He needed to get some of his missiles on the newly converted communist island. In 1962, Khrushchev made his move and thereby precipitated a crisis with the United States over the Soviet deployment of nuclear missiles in Cuba. The Cuban Missile Crisis was the closest the world had ever come to nuclear war. The United States armed forces were at their highest state of readiness ever, and Soviet field commanders in Cuba were prepared to use battlefield nuclear weapons to defend the island if it was invaded. Luckily, thanks to the bravery of two men, President John F. Kennedy and Premier Nikita Khrushchev, war was averted. Soviet Army Chief of Operations Anatoly Gribkov stated, "Nuclear catastrophe was hanging by a thread, and we weren't counting days or hours, but minutes." It should be noted that I borrowed much of the information in this section from the years-ago historical writing of Kurt Viersma and Ben Larson. Let's take a step-by-step look at how the crisis developed and how Kennedy and Khrushchev averted a nuclear war. May 1962. The Soviet Union was desperately behind the United States in the arms race. Soviet missiles were only powerful enough to be launched against Europe, but U.S. missiles were capable of striking the entire Soviet Union. Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev conceived the idea of placing intermediate-range missiles in Cuba. A deployment in Cuba would double the Soviet strategic arsenal and provide a real deterrent to a potential U.S. attack against the Soviet Union. Meanwhile, Fidel Castro was looking for a way to defend his island nation from an attack by the U.S. Ever since the failed Bay of Pigs invasion in 1961, Castro felt a second attack was inevitable. Consequently, he approved Khrushchev's plan to place missiles on the island. In the summer of 1962, the Soviet Union worked quickly and secretly to build its missile installations in Cuba. It should be noted that Khrushchev was encouraged to make his move at this time because of the U.S. military exercise in 1962. The armed forces conducted a mock invasion of a Caribbean island to overthrow a fictitious dictator whose name, Ortsak, was Castro spelled backwards. Additionally, the U.S. was drafting a plan to invade Cuba, Operation Mongoose. The mock invasion and invasion plan were devised to keep Castro nervous. Finally, the CIA had also been running covert operations throughout Cuba, trying to damage the Castro government. Consequently, Castro was convinced the U.S. was serious about invading Cuba. Castro had a great fear that the U.S. was going to invade Cuba. Since he had come to power in 1959, Cuban Premier Fidel Castro was aware of several U.S. attempts to oust him. The first was the failed Bay of Pigs invasion by CIA-backed Cuban exiles in 1961. Khrushchev promoted the KGB station chief in Cuba, Alexander Alexeyev, to ambassador to negotiate for Castro's approval of the plan. Castro supported the deployment because he believed it better to risk a great crisis than wait impotently for an invasion. July 1962. Castro accepted Khrushchev's offer, and the Soviet Union began its buildup of offensive weapons in Cuba. Throughout the late summer and early fall of 1962, the Soviets ferried launch equipment and personnel necessary for the preparation of missiles to Cuba. For fear of being discovered, they could not use military ships. Therefore, civilian vessels were used. In one instance, troops rode on a cruise liner posing as tourists. In all, 60 missiles and their warheads were transported to Cuba. As the U.S. monitored the increased shipping activity to Cuba, rumors began to circulate in Washington. On August 10, 1962, John McCone, director of the Central Intelligence Agency, sent the president a memorandum indicating his belief that the Soviets would place medium-range ballistic missiles, MRBMs, in Cuba. August 29th, a U-2 reconnaissance flight over Cuba revealed the presence of SA-2 SAM, surface-to-air missile sites. In an attempt to reassure the Congress and the public, Kennedy announced on September 4th the presence of Soviet defense missiles in Cuba, SA-2 SAMs, but stated that there were no offensive weapons. On the same day, Soviet Ambassador Anatoly Dobrynin assured Attorney General Robert Kennedy that no offensive missiles would be placed in Cuba. September 15th, the first Soviet missiles, MRBMs, arrived. October 9th, under increasing pressure from congressmen and intelligence officers, Kennedy ordered another U-2 flight over Cuba for October 9th. Due to bad weather, the flight was delayed until Sunday, October 14th. Richard Heiser took off in a U-2 from Texas and headed over Cuba. When he landed in Florida, a one-star general was there to receive the film. Heiser, a veteran pilot, immediately sensed something urgent. One-star generals do not normally run errands. October 15th. For the United States, the crisis began on October 15, 1962, when reconnaissance photographs revealed Soviet missiles under construction in Cuba. After analyzing the pictures from the Heiser flight, the National Photographic Interpretation Center found what they thought were more surface-to-air missile sites. Closer inspection revealed, however, six much larger missiles, each 60 to 65 feet long. What the photo interpreters had discovered were SS-4 nuclear missiles. October 16th. Early the next day, President John Kennedy was informed of the missile installations. McGeorge Bundy, National Security Advisor, said, "Mr. President, there is now hard photographic evidence that the Russians have offensive missiles in Cuba." Still in his pajamas, President Kennedy was informed of the missiles in Cuba during his breakfast. He did not react, but it was now clear that for months the Soviets had purposely been deceiving the American president. Kennedy immediately took charge and scheduled two meetings for that morning. First, he wanted to see the photographs himself. Looking over the photos, Kennedy remarked, "They look like footballs on a football field." The missiles he held in his sight had a range of 1,100 miles and threatened major population centers in the U.S., including New York, Washington, D.C., and Philadelphia. At this point, the missiles were not yet operational, nor were they fitted with nuclear warheads. But as Marshall Carter, deputy director of the CIA, so accurately assessed, they soon would be. The second meeting of the day Kennedy scheduled for 11:45. He selected a hand-picked group of trusted government officials to advise him on the crisis. The assembled group was later referred to as the Executive Committee of the National Security Council, or XCOM. In that first meeting, Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara outlined three possible courses of action for the U.S. to take against Cuba and the Soviet Union. One, the political course of action, to engage Castro and Khrushchev on the diplomatic stage in a gamble to resolve the crisis openly, an option which most members of XCOM deemed unlikely to succeed. Two, a course of action that would involve declaration of open surveillance combined with a blockade against offensive weapons entering Cuba. Three, military action directed against Cuba, starting with an air attack against the missiles and then followed by an invasion. XCOM worked from the premise that the missile warheads were not yet in Cuba and not attached to the missiles. Therefore, the goal of any action they proposed was to stop the warheads from reaching Cuba or to prevent the missiles from becoming fully operational. A majority of the discussion that first day revolved around option number 3 and how the Soviets would respond. What XCOM didn't know was that the Soviets did indeed have nuclear warheads on the island. They had also installed battlefield nuclear weapons in Cuba and were prepared to fire them to halt an invasion. In taking a stance on Cuba, Kennedy wanted to appear tough, yet avoid a military confrontation. No matter what action the U.S. took, XCOM expected Khrushchev to retaliate. In order to maintain secrecy, Kennedy followed his planned schedule. As of yet, the Soviets didn't know the Americans knew of the missiles in Cuba. The American public didn't know yet either. If the Soviets found out, they might hide the missiles or launch them if they were ready. If the public found out, the nation would panic. Consequently, Kennedy broke off no public engagements for the next 4 days. October 17th. On Wednesday, Kennedy flew to Connecticut to campaign for the Democratic Party and congressional candidate Abe Ribicoff. During the speech, he was in a good mood, and he even joked. But as soon as Kennedy entered his car to return to Washington, he became serious. Every spare moment was spent concentrating on the crisis. Robert Kennedy and Theodore Sorensen met the president at the airport and filled him in on what he had missed during that day's deliberations. Throughout XCOM's discussions, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and especially the Air Force, strongly argued for an airstrike. The Air Force suggested bombing Cuba with over 100 sorties, but Kennedy would ask, "How many bombs do you want, and what do you want to bomb?" Before the Air Force was done, they had planned a massive air attack that would have wiped Cuba off the planet's surface. After another U-2 flight on the night of the 17th, the military discovered intermediate-range IRBMs, SS-5, nuclear missiles. With the exception of Washington and Oregon, these missiles could reach all of the continental U.S. October 18th. On October 18th, Kennedy fulfilled a previously scheduled engagement to meet with Soviet Foreign Minister Andrei Gromyko. The meeting was a strange one. XCOM wasn't sure if Gromyko knew of the missiles, or if he knew that the Americans knew. Consequently, Kennedy decided not to confront the minister on this issue. The meeting began with a polite exchange over minor world events, but soon shifted to Cuba. Gromyko read a statement to Kennedy, saying that Soviet aid was solely for the purpose of contributing to the defense capabilities of Cuba and to the development of its peaceful democracy. If it were otherwise, the Soviet government would have never become involved in rendering such assistance. In response, Kennedy reread a statement he had made on September 4th, saying the U.S. would not tolerate offensive weapons in Cuba. Gromyko must have wondered why Kennedy was reading him the statement. But when he later reported to Khrushchev, he said all was well with the Americans. After the meeting, Kennedy remarked to an advisor that he wanted to take the enlarged reconnaissance photographs out of his desk, point to the missiles, and ask Gromyko, "What do these look like?" Later that evening, a black-tie dinner was held in Gromyko's honor. As the guests entered the State Department to attend the ball, XCOM was preparing to meet just one floor below. During the discussion, a majority opinion had been reached on recommending a blockade. Those with an opposing view continued to dissent, but the majority group wanted to head to the White House to inform the president. Instead of attracting attention by arriving in a convoy of official black cars, Edwin Martin of the CIA walked the few blocks, and the rest, 9 members in all, squeezed into Robert Kennedy's limousine for the short drive. On the way, one member commented, "It will be some story if this car is in an accident." At the White House, Kennedy liked the idea of the blockade because it provided the Soviets a way out of the crisis. But because XCOM still hadn't reached a consensus, Kennedy instructed his speechwriter, Theodore Sorensen, to draft two different speeches to give to the American public on October 22nd, one announcing a blockade and the other announcing an airstrike. Kennedy still hadn't decided on the best course of action. Before leaving for a campaign trip to the Midwest, Kennedy met with the Joint Chiefs, who still promoted the idea of airstrikes. A consensus still couldn't be reached. Therefore, Kennedy, who was already late, asked his brother to continue the XCOM meetings to draw up full plans for both scenarios. He had chosen not to cancel this trip because he wanted to maintain secrecy. October 20. On Saturday, with Kennedy still gone on the campaign trip, XCOM met to discuss the two speeches being prepared. They approved them with a few minor changes, and then Robert Kennedy called the president to say that he had to come back to Washington. The president was reluctant to do so, but he and Robert felt there should be a final consensus. It was necessary, then, that he returns and discusses with XCOM the two options, a surgical airstrike or quarantine. The president finally agreed. Canceling his trip by saying that he had an upper respiratory infection, he returned to Washington. Between 1:30 and 2:30 p.m., he met with XCOM. Roswell Gilpatrick, Deputy Secretary of Defense, summed up Kennedy's choices. He said, "Essentially, Mr. President, this is a choice between limited action and unlimited action, and most of us think it is better to start with limited action." The president liked the idea of a blockade because it allowed the U.S. to start with minimal action and increase the pressure on the Soviets as needed. Kennedy would not, however, finalize his decision until the next day. October 21st. Kennedy met with his top advisors to further discuss the missiles in Cuba. He asked General Walter Sweeney, the head of Strategic Air Command, if an airstrike could destroy all the missiles. The general replied that they could take out all the missiles they knew about. Sweeney could not predict 100% success. Next, Kennedy asked the general how many casualties, civilian and military, would occur. The general responded, 10,000 to 20,000. The only reasonable option left was a blockade against Cuba. In the speech Kennedy would give the nation, he would use the word quarantine instead of blockade. This suggestion, made by George Ball, Under Secretary of State, was an important one. A blockade, as defined under international treaties, is an act of war. Quarantine, on the other hand, is merely an attempt to keep something unwanted out of a particular area. In sum, the U.S. could have its blockade, but the international community would not consider it an act of war. Later in the day, the press contacted Kennedy, wanting to know about the situation in Cuba. The press knew that there were offensive weapons in Cuba and that Kennedy was preparing a plan to deal with the threat. Kennedy asked the reporters to remain quiet. He even personally telephoned the Washington Post and the New York Times to ask them to tone down their coverage of Cuba. He went on to warn that if he was denied the element of surprise, "I don't know," he said, "what the Soviets will do." Another U-2 flight that day revealed bombers and MiGs being rapidly assembled and cruise missile sites being built on Cuba's northern shore. On Monday, preparations had to be made for Kennedy's 7 p.m. Eastern Time address to the nation. A flurry of activity ensued. The State Department informed American allies around the world of Kennedy's decision. U.S. Senate leaders were called to Washington for a special briefing. They came out of the briefing surprised and doubting the effectiveness of quarantine. Many wanted an airstrike. Almost 300 Navy ships set sail, not yet having received the specific orders for quarantine. In Guantanamo Bay, three Marine battalions were brought in to reinforce the base, and military dependents were evacuated. Military alert was raised to DEFCON 3, and instructions were given to be ready to launch missiles within minutes of the president's speech. 20 planes armed with nuclear bombs were also in the air, ready to strike the USSR. At 7 p.m., Precisely as Kennedy was beginning his speech, jet fighters took off from bases in Florida and headed south towards Cuba. If Castro decided to respond militarily, they would be ready. For the next 17 minutes, Americans and citizens around the world sat glued to their TV sets listening to the American president. Here now is an excerpt from the president's speech from October 22, 1962, as provided by the John F. Kennedy Presidential Library and Museum.
Good evening, my fellow citizens. This government, as promised, has maintained the closest surveillance of the Soviet military buildup on the island of Cuba. Within the past week, unmistakable evidence has established the fact that a series of offensive missile sites is now in preparation on that imprisoned island. The purpose of these bases can be none other than to provide a nuclear strike capability against the Western Hemisphere. I have directed that the following initial steps be taken immediately. First, to halt this offensive buildup, a strict quarantine on all offensive military equipment under shipment to Cuba is being initiated. Second, I have directed the continued and increased close surveillance of Cuba and its military buildup. Third, it shall be the policy of this nation to regard any nuclear missile launched from Cuba against any nation in the Western Hemisphere as an attack by the Soviet Union on the United States, requiring a full retaliatory response upon the Soviet Union.
Earlier in the day, Kennedy had sent Khrushchev a copy of his speech. Upon reading it, Khrushchev became infuriated. He was angry with his military for not successfully hiding the missiles, and he was angered by the American quarantine, which, no matter what they called it, was an act of war. Khrushchev's first response was to instruct the ships on their way to Cuba not to stop. Later that night, Khrushchev sent a response to Kennedy. I must say, frankly, that the measures indicated in your statement constitute a serious threat to peace and to the security of nations. We reaffirm that the armaments which are in Cuba, regardless of the classification to which they may belong, are intended solely for defensive purposes. I hope the United States government will display wisdom and renounce the actions pursued by you, which may lead to catastrophic consequences for world peace. In response to Kennedy's speech, Castro mobilized all of Cuba's military forces. The Cubans, however, were not surprised by Kennedy, for the U.S. had constantly threatened them. Ever since the Bay of Pigs, 18 months earlier, the Cubans had been living under a constant fear of invasion. The crisis of October was little different from any other month. October 22nd, Kennedy announced the discovery of the missile installations to the public and his decision to quarantine the island. He also proclaimed that any nuclear missile launched from Cuba would be regarded as an attack on the United States by the Soviet Union, and demanded that the Soviets remove all of their offensive weapons from Cuba. During the public phase of the crisis, tensions began to build on both sides. Kennedy eventually ordered low-level reconnaissance missions every 2 hours. October 23rd. On the 23rd, Kennedy ordered 6 Crusader jets to fly a low-level reconnaissance mission. The mission, flown at 350 feet and at 350 knots, brought back stunning close-up pictures of the missile sites and also showed that the Soviets were testing the missiles for launch. One of the pilots, William Ecker, commented that, "When you can almost see the writing on the side of the missiles, then you really know what you've got." On the same day, the Organization of American States, OAS, unanimously approved of the quarantine against Cuba. These countries realized that they were also threatened by the missiles in Cuba. With the backing of the Western Hemisphere, Kennedy signed the actual proclamation of interdiction in the early evening. The quarantine was to take effect at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on October 24th. By the end of the day, U.S. ships had taken up position along the quarantine line 800 miles from Cuba. they were instructed to use force to halt any ship that failed to stop at that line. Late in the evening, the president sent Robert Kennedy to the Soviet embassy to talk with Ambassador Dobrynin. Well before the crisis, the administration had developed this channel of communication with the USSR. It allowed both countries to discuss matters privately and quietly. At 9:30 p.m., Robert Kennedy arrived at the embassy and proceeded to chastise the Soviet ambassador for having lied to the United States about placing missiles in Cuba. He responded that as far as he knew, there were no offensive weapons there. As Robert Kennedy left the building, he held out his hand in despair and said, "I do not know how this will end." Shortly afterward, Dobrynin wrote a message summarizing the meeting to be cabled to Khrushchev. Because communications were still in an infant stage then, Dobrynin had to call a Western Union telegraph station in Washington, which sent a bike messenger to pick up the cable. Dobrynin recalls urging the messenger to travel back to the station with the utmost speed. October 24th. On the 24th, XCOM convened at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, the exact time the blockade began. The mood was tense. Soviet ships kept coming closer and closer to the line. American ships were preparing to disable them if they did not stop. The order given to the American ships was to first communicate with the Soviet vessels. Then, if they did not stop, the Americans were to fire across their bow. And finally, if they still did not stop, American ships were instructed to blow off the rudder in order to stop the ship's forward progress. Two of the major concerns during the XCOM meeting were the Soviet submarines accompanying the vessels and the possibility that Khrushchev had not had enough time to instruct the ship captains on what they should do. At 10:25, XCOM received a message that the Soviet ships were turning back. Everyone in the room breathed a sigh of relief. Khrushchev was not ready to expand the crisis by challenging the blockade. Upon hearing the good news, Secretary of State Dean Rusk turned to McGeorge Bundy and said, "We've been eyeball to eyeball, and the other fellow just blinked." This did not mean, however, that the crisis was over. Also on Wednesday, military alert was raised to DEFCON 2, the highest level ever in U.S. history. The notification sent round the world from Strategic Air Command headquarters was purposely left uncoded to let the Soviets know just how serious the Americans were. The military could, at a moment's notice, launch an attack on Cuba or the Soviet Union. That evening, the White House received a second letter from Khrushchev. "You, Mr. President, are not declaring quarantine, but rather are advancing an ultimatum and threatening that if we do not give in to your demands, you will use force." "No, Mr. President, I cannot agree to this, and I think that in your own heart you recognize that I am correct. I am convinced that in my place you would act the same way. Therefore, the Soviet government cannot instruct the captains of Soviet vessels bound for Cuba to observe the orders of the American naval forces blockading that island. Naturally, we will not simply be bystanders with regard to piratical acts by American ships on the high seas. We will then be forced on our part to take the measures we consider necessary and adequate to protect our rights. We have everything necessary to do so. National security must come first. We can't negotiate with a gun at our head. If they won't remove the missiles and restore status quo ante, we will do it ourselves."